for the mathematical sciences, and I'd like to especially welcome Dr. Yuri Gurevich, who is our distinguished chair. My name is Manfred Trummer. I'm the site director here at SFU, and at PIMS we're very proud of this program because it's a wonderful opportunity for us to get very well-known and famous people to come here for a period of time and to work with our faculty here. And so if you have any other bright ideas about how to enhance this program, let us know. And Dr. Gurevich will be back in July for a period of time when he will be giving some more seminars. But today is his big introductory talk. And I'll pass the floor on to Evgenia, who is one of the local hosts for Dr. Gurevich.
Hi, I'm Evgenia Zanowska. I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Yuri Gurevich from Microsoft Research, who is our guest today, PIMS Distinguished Chair for 2023. Dr. Gurevich is a professor emeritus of electrical engineering and computer science at the University of Michigan. His career spans research in algebra, computer science, and logic. He is the fellow for the Association for Computing Machinery. He is a doctor honoris causa of the University of Limburg, Belgium, as well as a fellow of the John Simon Cunningham Memorial Foundation, among other honors. And as Manfred mentioned, there will be a series of lectures that Dr. Gurevich will give in July. That series will be announced at the PIMS list. And it's my pleasure to have Dr. Gurevich give his talk.
Thank you very much. Start. Oops. I thought that in good American tradition I'll start with advertisement, but it has been already advertised, so I'll proceed. So the story that I'm going to tell started with hiring a logician by the University of Michigan. And the logician was hired on the promise to become a computer scientist. And so I wanted to become a computer scientist, so I was happy to try to keep my end of the bargain. They gave me tenure, and I had in such situation, I didn't have to prove anything to anybody very quickly. And I wanted to understand, what is it, computer science? What is it really about? And it was not obvious to me at all. So what do you study in computer science? You know, in physics you study atoms and subatomic particles. More or less we know what it is. You know, in chemistry you have these molecules and various things. But what do we study in computer science? And more relevant to my research, how do we describe, what can a mathematician or a logician do in computer science? So if you go to physics, then you have these partial differential equations, which, well, not necessarily partial, differential equations that describe the reality. So what is the PDEs of computer science? And by the way, I'm not making this up. I wanted somehow to understand. And of course, I tried to just talk to my colleagues. And didn't get very far. So, and most of them, or all of them, knew so much more. And so, I tried somehow to think on my own. What is it about? One thing that occurred to me, that computer science is not really a natural science. Okay. There is a part of it, say, complexity theory, kind of more a mathematical part. But much of it is about artifacts, which we build. In that sense, it's very different from natural sciences like physics or chemistry. You know, if people from another, people or whatever, whoever they are, from another civilization come to us, they probably do the same mathematics and probably do similar physics. But what kind of computers they use, it may be no resemblance whatsoever. So in this connection, I thought that computer science is actually a good name. So one argument against it, but any science which has science in the name is not a good science. But on the other hand, it is a science about computers. The informatics, another popular name for the, for our science, is somehow stresses this the objective part, the natural part of computer science, or mathematical part. But I think the core of computer science is really about those artifacts. And as I mentioned, PDEs are some kind of models. Notice that if you're a mathematician, then before you start to reason about a reality, you need some kind of a model. So if you go to theoretical physics, you know, of course, they use the names, you know, protons or quarks or whatever. But in their minds, it's a, there is this formal apparatus of quantum mechanics or whatever they deal with. And so we need this kind of models of this reality that we deal with. So the reality should be formalized first. So that harks back to this question, what are the PDEs of computer science? And you have to fix a certain level of abstraction. You know, if you look at any computing process like this little PC or laptop, you can view it on many, many levels. You can think about zero ones in computer memory. You can think about the level of operating systems, which was much higher, much more sophisticated, and then the level of this application, which is a PowerPoint. Or you can go down. You can look at the electrical in the level down, depends, of course, on point of view. The electrical engineering part of it, and maybe even underlying physics. So before you formalize, there is no chance to formalize it all. So you have to fix a level of abstraction. And when I thought about it in those times, it occurred to me, also seeing what my fellow theorists do, it occurred to me that modeling is so hard all by itself, it probably should not be mixed with reasoning. Not that there is anything wrong with reasoning. What I mean, of course you should think what you're doing, but reasoning about a model. So most systems that I saw had somehow both parts, modeling and reasoning. So imagine you describe something in some kind of logic, in, say, temporal logic or whatever. Then you're already in your logic. Okay? And when you create your model, you're a little apprehensive. Will you be able to reason? Or maybe your logic doesn't even allow certain things. Okay? And so I made very early this decision, I'm very happy that I did, to separate modeling from reasoning about those models. So first model. Okay, don't even think how you will be reasoning. So just try to make your model very faithful to your reality at the chosen abstraction level. And then when you have a model, then the reasoning problem arises. huge problem, it seemed to me, was the dynamics. How do we deal with changing reality? And in mathematics, let me see, I'm going to say something which may be construed of as as negative remark. So first I say that I'm really a mathematician. When Microsoft, a particular one of the directors of research who is now my boss, his name is Jim Kajia, when he raised this idea that I come to research and create a group, I told him, Jim, do you realize that I'm really a mathematician? He said, that's all right. So the mathematics we love has something in common with autopsy. And here is what I mean. The standard mathematical way to deal with changing reality, with motion, is to eliminate any change, eliminate any motion. What you study in mathematics, typically, is not the motion, but the history of a motion. That's why I use this word autopsy, just as a provocation. So I'll give an example. Suppose you go to mechanics. Okay, there is a certain process, and you write differential equation. You have dx, dt, dy, dt, dz, dt, and of course everything depends on time, and of course it's motion. And then you do some change of coordinates, and now you have dt dx, dy dx, dz dx, and now everything develops into future, now it develops to the right or to the left, depending on your political preferences. In any case, it shows that the time axis is just one of those axes, like just another dimension. So really, you have the whole history of the motion, and you're moving this history to the right, to the left, and to up and down, and to the future, and back into past. And as a mathematician, you often get, at least I was always annoyed when you read some engineering books or physics books, they always start with this delta x and delta t, and you say, what's the, why don't you go immediately to the limit and write dx dt and quickly get your equation? But they don't think this way. They think about change. Before they come to reality, they think about a real motion. I'd like to think about a computation, or a physical process for that matter, as an evolution of state, rather than a history where you have all the states parameterized by parameter t. Okay. So each time you have just one state at this particular time. And there is past, and there will be future, but currently we have just one state. And it's since it's artificial reality, in a sense it's easier. So you can stop this computer in a particular state, like a PowerPoint is now in a particular state. Now, you cannot stop a physical process. So when you read about, books in physics, they can consider a process at time t0, but it's an abstraction, an illusion. You cannot stop the process and examine everything at time t0. That time doesn't wait for you. Okay. Also, there is no next state. Okay. So it was the genius of Newton and Leibniz to come up with infinitesimals and so on, somehow fake this next state. You say delta t, so t plus delta t is the next moment. But it's not really the next moment. It's a little approximation which becomes better and better, and then dt grows to zero. And when it's zero, then it's the same state. It's not the next state. But with computers, you do have the next state. We should take advantage of it. And so the methods which were popular at the time, like denotational semantics, algebraic specification, they seem not to take advantage of it. Very good methods, just don't misunderstand me. I don't want to take them apart. I think they are, each of them has a lot of insights. But not this one, not this particular insight. So I opted for what is called operational approach. So rather than describing modeling in logics or systems like that, I describe them as kind of machines, which are in certain states and have transitions. And it was quite odd at the time. So my fellow theorists were quite, didn't know how to interpret this. At the time, only the engineers who don't know any better worked with operational approach, because it seemed such implementational, so low level. And the popular point of view was, the conventional point of view was, that operational approaches are too implementational, too low level. And you have to work declaratively. Fortunately, you don't have to choose only declarative, non-operational at all, as some try to do it. There are some very pure functional languages. And of course, they only succeed when they lose their purity. And on the other hand, people in the engineers, so to speak, people who do programming languages, then they eventually also learn to use declarative tools, so like constraints, preconditions, postconditions. So, to my taste, the operational approach is the main one, and then you aid, help in the process with various declarative features. So what is a state? And there are two point of views, how to view state. Maybe there are more, but that's the point of view aware of and which I want to contrast. One is familiar to you with the finite automata theory. So in the theory of finite automata, or any kind of automata, you have a space of states, and each state is just a point. So the structure is, the state itself has no structure. It's just a point. And what is structured is the space of state. Okay. So see some similarity with the way mathematicians formalize change and motion. Okay. So you have all the possible states at once. Okay. And you reason about them. And that may be very fruitful. Automata theory was incredibly, incredibly successful. But there is another point of view which programmers have. And for a programmer, state looks very differently. State has structure. And by itself, one state could be huge. And there is just one state. Typically, there is just one state. And the programmer is like a little ant living in this huge state, changing it slowly, locally. So we will be going for this structured state approach. Another distinction is between explicit and implicit state. When you study some programming language, say C, you may read that a state is given by the values of the variables. And that's not true. So imagine you have a C program with variables X, Y, Z, and suppose you know X is 1, Y2Z3. You don't necessarily know the state. You have to know where you are in the program. Now, if the program has recursive functions, as they say, recursive procedures, then you have to know the stack, because there is this procedure stack with, you know, frames. Each of these frames on the stack has a lot of information, you know, some kind of unfinished, partially finished computation there. And that's all in that state. If you don't know this information, you don't really know all about state. So there is this huge implicit part of the state. And that's why it's so difficult to reason about state or even understand it. And so I try to experiment and consider a state which is fully explicit. Nothing is hidden. Again, hiding information is great for many, many purposes. For modularization, for security, and so on. But you have to separate concerns. First, let's understand what's computing all about without these concerns. And from that point of view, it turns out it was beneficial to look at an explicit state. And just a remark, any state is always abstract. Even if you go to the level of machine commands. By the way, when I talk to some programmers in Microsoft, there are some brilliant programmers. You know, it's America. People go where they're paid well. And so you see some people in these programming groups who could prove theorem, a good theorem, and do anything. Just brilliant people. But also you see programmers who are not so brilliant. And for many of them, the level of C is the God-given level. So the level what we usually coming and try to talk to them is high level. But the C is not God-given. It's just a familiar level for them. There are lower levels, like assembly level, the machine level. Okay. But again, you can go lower than machine level. You can look, what is this zero, what is this one? You know, there are some electrical part, and so on. So whenever we speak about states in computer science, it's always an abstract state. And one key observation in this story that I'm explaining was this, that explicit states are what logicians call structures, what algebraists call algebras. Now, this is not a theorem, it's kind of observation, but it held up quite well and allowed simplify many things, and we don't know any counterexample to it. And if you do work with an explicit state, then indeed you may have this phenomenon that the only thing that changes from one state to another are the variables, nothing else, because nothing is hidden. And working with explicit state in the form of logician structure allowed me to make this most basic observation in the theory which I'm presenting you, that in this situation, there are very few commands that you need to program anything. Now, if you look at C, there are many, many commands. And if you go from C to Java, again, there is a huge number of commands, some similar, some different. But it is, to a large extent, due to this hidden, implicit part of the state. And if everything is explicit, all you do is change your variables. So here is let me just go. These abstract state machines used to be called evolving algebras. So algebra, because a state, what logicians call structure, algebra is called algebras. And this algebra evolves. So the computation is an algebra that evolves, evolving algebra. Okay. Later on, a group of evolving algebraists in Siemens suggested to change this name because apparently engineers didn't like this algebra part. And the name was changed to abstract state machines. So here's a little example which exhibits all commands that you need into programming sequential algorithms. So one command is this, an assignment. Another is if then else. And the third one is do in parallel. Okay. So it turns out that in the sequential case, you will not need anything more. This is part of this thesis that I will be talking about. And I already talked 2 years ago here at the Meckler's lecture. And in July, I will be speaking on this very, very explicitly. So this particular algorithm is, as you can guess, it's the classical Euclidean algorithm. But the whole program describes just one step in this algorithm. So in a sense, it's theorists' programming language, like a Turing machine. The whole program describes just one step. So there is a kind of iteration loop around it, implicitly. Okay. I put this do in parallel in square brackets because we usually omit. So in abstract state machines, parallel is the default because we usually describe one step. So in one step, almost anything you do is in parallel. Now, this is a sequential case, so there is parallelism, but it's bounded. You can do two things at once in parallel, or seven things, but only bounded many things. Here is another example. For those of you who attended my Tuesday's lecture, you already seen it. So this is another algorithm which computes... let's see. You start with a graph, a directed graph, and you have a set I of nodes. Okay. Here is this yellow nodes. And what you compute, all nodes reachable from those yellow nodes. Okay. And here's the algorithm. So here the variable is a set. Okay. So it could be anything. In contrary, say, to C or Java, in abstract state machines, a variable could be a set, could be a map, could be a map of sets or sets of maps. So the variable symbols are initially uninterpreted. And so that gives a great power. They can be anything you wish them to be. So in this case, we have only one variable, which is a set. And in the initial state, it's supposed to be the empty state set. And so in the first step, you initialize. So what I'm showing you, the result of the first step. After the first step, you perform this. So let's see, what do you do? For every edge with the yellow beginning and blue end, you take this blue end and put it into the yellow part. Okay? So let me do one step. So let me do another step. yet another step. And now we're finished. Because if I do another step, state will not change. Okay. So we say you reached fixed point. So the main ambition of this abstract state machine approach is this thesis. Of course, I started from Turing's thesis. That was the inspiration. And an immediate question is how abstract abstract state machines are better than Turing machines, or how they are more advanced. Because are they Turing complete? Because Turing machines allow you to compute every function. Why do you need anything more? So 3 years ago, I was giving a talk in Microsoft to Bill Gates. So Bill Gates and a few people who came with him. And at this point, he asked this, okay, a slightly different talk, but when I arrived to the thesis, he asked how it's different from Turing machines. And the difference is that Turing machines, in Turing machines, you don't really capture your algorithm closely. Okay? So suppose your algorithm is matrix multiplication. Okay? Then the algorithm may work in one step. So if you program it in PL1, and you have two matrices to multiply, PL1 is such an ancient language. And in this language, there's just command. You can multiply matrices in one step. Now, a Turing machine cannot do it in one step. Yeah. So it will take it a while. In abstract state machines, you model the intuitive algorithm very closely, in particular, step for step. So if the algorithm works in one step or in seven steps, then the abstract state machine will simulate it in one step or respectively seven steps. So it's a very faithful simulation. And you may say, what's a big deal? Why it's so important step for step? Suppose I spend two steps to simulate one step. It's very important. Because you imagine that we simulate a component. One of many components in distributed computation. And the system usually guarantees the integrity of only one step. So if my model needs two steps to simulate one step of the component, then some other component can intervene in between my two steps and completely spoil the simulation. So it's really important to be able to simulate step for step. So what the thesis says, take any computer system. Any algorithm or operating system, whatever. Fix an abstraction level. There exists an abstract state machine which is, as far as behavior is concerned, which is just identical. It's the same states, same transitions. So the difference is syntactic. So your algorithm could be programmed in C, and this one will be programmed in this strange language of logicians. So the thesis has a theoretical confirmation. And I will be speaking about this at length in July. So you may say, how can you prove a thesis? You know, thesis is not a theorem. So what you can do you can formalize all the notions that occur in the thesis. And of course, and then try to derive, then try to prove the thesis. Okay. Now, to what extent this formalization is satisfactory, it will be up to you to judge. Similar attempts were made with the Turing's thesis. There is also an extensive experimental confirmation in academia. But the people who worked on it in academia, Uwe is one distinguished representative of that group, these people typically didn't care about the thesis. What they discovered, that there is this something which allows them to describe things faithfully. So they use it for simulation, for testing, for specification, and similar purposes. So there is a story of SDL, one very impressive story where Uwe played a pivotal role, but I'll skip it. A group of German professors competed for a task of doing something formally for International Telecommunication Union, and they used abstract state machines and won hands down. So whatever they did became an official standard and so on. And having Uwe here, you probably, if you haven't heard the story, I'm sure you will. So let me save time. There is plenty of experimentation in industry, not only at Microsoft, though there is no other place where ASMs were used that much. But Microsoft wasn't the first, say Siemens was there earlier. Now I wanted to say a few words about specifications, and it's probably preach to the choir for those of you who took or taught software engineering. This is a very standard topic. Specifications are very important. You know, imagine you work for some company, you develop some product. Now, what product do you develop? You better have a good specification, otherwise many, many misunderstandings arise. Because if it's, you know, as it usually is, some text in natural language with little pictures and schemas, and typically the developers interpret it in the narrow sense, because they are the ones who write the code, and the marketing department develops it in the broadest possible sense. And many misunderstandings arise. So it's very important to have a spec which can be interpreted, which is precise. It allows various implementations, but at the desired level of abstraction, there is only one interpretation. Okay, here is more. I speak slow. You, I'm sure, read very much faster, so you probably read it. So let me. This V diagram, so-called V diagram, appears often in software textbooks. What happens in an industry when many, like in Microsoft, tens of thousands or even tens of thousands of people may be involved in production of in the developing one product like Windows or Office. So typically you start with certain system requirements and then you make them a little more detailed and split the work between different groups and then more detailed, and eventually code is written, and then you test code locally, say in one team, and then between neighboring teams, and so on it goes. And what happens, the things that were there in the very beginning are tested at the very end. And this is very dangerous. Imagine something was wrong to begin with. Now try to correct it now. So what would you like to do, of course, is this. So when you have a system requirement, model it. Play with this model. Debug it. And so on every single level. So in particular, there are many, many benefits. One social benefit is that the testers are involved very early. So imagine you work as a tester, or maybe test lead, or test architect, say at Microsoft. So at certain point, product is dumped on you. Test. Okay, there's a few miles of code. What do you test? So it's just extremely difficult just to understand what the product is supposed to do. Now, product does not come without documentation, but documentation, as a rule, is very, I would say, imperfect. Okay. And Microsoft is, the situation in Microsoft is quite normal, usual, very typical for software industry. Okay. In fact, now Microsoft makes a strong effort to improve on this front, and our group and this particular approach also is part of this effort. So the language of ASMs that I showed you is sort of in principle captures any computer system, but it is still theoretical language. If you want to actually use it, you need a very practical language. And few such languages were developed before I came to Microsoft, which happened almost 5 years ago. So at University of Paderborn, where Uwe was one of his graduate students, I think you co-advised him with somebody else, right? So developed ASM Workbench. These are not the even preceding tools, but these are more powerful tools. This tool probably was the most, I don't know, maybe a tie between these two. Both were relatively successful. So this one was used in Siemens. And this tool was developed in Berlin. And the developer, Matthias Anlauf, is now in Kestrel. But by now, the tool developed at Microsoft Research, which is called ASML, is probably the richest. And it's downloadable. You can download and play with it and use it. Certainly in academia. It is a specification language. So I often ask, isn't it just a programming language? You know, why not to use, say, Java? And indeed, it's a kind of delicate problem. ASML is a programming language. Nevertheless, we usually insist that it's a specification language. And the difference is, what do you stress? So it will be not so if... it's not an inefficient language, but it's not designed to optimize efficiency first. It's designed, first of all, to allow you to write programs which are easy to read. And you'll see examples. I'm afraid I go so slow. But you will see. And one important thing is this last one. Many, many specification language developed in academia cannot possibly make it in industry because they're kind of standalone, narcissistic. You know, if you use one of these, especially functional languages, you know, you have to speak this language. Everything should be adjusted to work with such a system. So, for example, SML was designed from scratch, and we didn't want to do that. So we started with a very beautiful functional language called Haskell. Very beautiful syntax, clean, but it didn't work. This language has its own idea of about write types, and information had to be marshaled from Haskell to operating system or to other components, and it was not multi-threaded and so on and so forth. So this is very, very important. One interesting, by the way, development, since people here from mathematics, from computer science, in mathematics, academia is the place to do mathematics. Okay, there are, you know, some institutes, you know, like, but where else you do mathematics? That's the place. You know, the greatest mathematicians like Poincaré or Kolmogorov, they work in academia. Hilbert. But in computer science, especially in computer engineering, probably as with any engineering discipline, it's very different. You know, certain developments are done in industry. So if you teach software engineering, there are certain things you will never taste unless you work or consult for industry, because the scale is very, very important. Mm-hmm. So here is a little example of ASML. So what we will do, we'll just write a sorting. But then we'll see what's special about the sorting. So you have some sequence, and you want to sort it. So how do you sort? Very primitively. You just choose a pair of indices and swap them. So this is done in parallel. Okay. So this is pure ASM. So if there was no ASML, that would be the whole thing. But ASML is a practical language. You have to explain to machine everything. So it's wrapped up as a certain procedure. And then there is kind of main. You step until fixed point. Now, it looks like a kind of rotten way to do sorting. But let's see. Notice that this is sorting, in-place sorting. You know, in-place means, for the mathematicians, that you don't copy data. You just work with a given sequence. Okay. One swap at a time. Okay. Now, notice that this is the most general way to do in-place swapping, one swap at a time. Okay. In that sense, it's not just a sorting algorithm, but it's the most general in-place one swap at a time sorting. And therefore, it is a spec for sorting. Okay. Now, there are much more sophisticated ways to sort, like quick sort. Okay. But it's sophisticated. You have to come up with this idea. Imagine that you do something you need sort. Just write this. And you don't want to commit. Maybe eventually you will not. Maybe a quick sort will be not good for you for some one reason or another. Maybe you don't need to be fast on average, but fast in some different sense. In the worst case, for example. In which case, quick sort is not so good. Okay. So this is a spec which allows you later on to write whatever. It's like a kind of contract. So it guarantees that things will be sorted, but allows you to use any kind of sorting in place once for at a time sorting. So that is one example of specification. Now I'll show a demo, and now I see that I'm badly running out of time. Okay, I see Uwe shows, that's okay. So if somebody has to leave, just don't hesitate. Okay. So I'll show you one demo, one and only demo of this presentation. So so-called topological sorting. I have no idea what's called topological sorting, but that's how they call it. So the problem is this. You have an acyclic graph, directed acyclic graph, with vertices E, with edges E. And what do you want to do? You want to arrange the vertices into a sequence such that every edge leads forward. Okay, let me give you another picture. Think about such a directed graph as a partial order, you know, just by transitivity. So if there is an arrow from A to B, from B to C, then mentally put also an arrow from A to C. Okay? So you have a kind of partial order, and what you want to complete this partial order to a total order in any possible way. You don't care which, but it should be total co-order. Okay. So here is mathematical observation which gives rise to an algorithm. And it is this. The graph is acyclic. Okay. Therefore, and finite, therefore, there exists a vertex without any incoming edges. Why? If not, go back into this incoming edge, have another vertex. If it has an incoming edge, go back again, and again, and again, and either you reach a vertex without any coming edges, or you have a cycle. Okay. So since graph is acyclic, take such a node, let me call this a source. Grab such a source, put it first. What remains is still acyclic graph. Grab another source, put it second, and so on. Okay. Clearly, what you will get will be the arrangement, a sequence of the kind you want. So I'll show how it's done in SML. So first of all, I want to know that's a typical way we write ASML programs. In these programs, you see text and color doesn't come up. It's a little more yellow, and yellow parts which are a program. So it's written in Word, and we have special in Word. I don't know whether you work with Word. It's a very, very sophisticated, huge thing, very complicated, but gives you a lot of ways for those who know how to deal with it. So in particular, they have so-called styles. And so we wrote a new style, call it ASML style. And so the program written in the ASML style. And when you put this thing to the machine, to the compiler, it will ignore everything else. It will take only the ASML style. Mm-hmm. So typically, our programs look actually differently. Typically, there is a lot of text and pictures, and then a piece of program. So the way we write what is called literate programming. Okay. So in this case, we start with declaring a class. It's an object-oriented language. It cannot be not object-oriented, because we have to work in a standard environment where everything is object-oriented. and also it gives a lot of benefits. But it allows you to be quite abstract. For example, this class, I will presume that you know a little about object orientation, otherwise I will never finish. So this class has no fields, no methods. It's really just a set. But formally, it's a class, and we have three variables: set of vertices, so set of type vertex. We have set of pair of vertices. Okay, so this is a type, and a sequence, initially empty. And here is the algorithm. So if it was just ASMs, so that would be the whole algorithm. Okay, but it's SML. I will even run for you, so that's a real thing. So let's see, what is this? You step until fixed point. This iteration loop now is made explicit. And now what do you do? So suppose you are somewhere in the middle of this process. So you have already built a portion of your sequence. Okay. Now you convert your sequence to a set. So this is the set of vertices which you already took away. Okay. So take all the original vertices without these, and this is the vertices that's left. Okay. So now the remaining... Now, first you check whether anything left. If nothing is left, you're finished. If anything is left, then what do you do? Consider all the vertices in this set X which satisfy this condition. Let's see, what is this condition? It says, does not exist vertex U with an edge to our vertex. So what it says, that V is a source. It doesn't have any incoming edges. That's it. So what I want to try to convince you that the language is very simple. You just write what you had in mind. Okay? And then you choose any element of this set. Okay. This any, semantically it's non-deterministic. In the real world, there is no such thing as non-determinism. So it's implemented as a random choice. So when you have your set, suppose it has 17 elements, then you randomly use random number generator built in every operating system and randomly choose an element out of 17 and you get some. Okay. Let me notice one possible problem, maybe even probable. If the graph happened to be cyclic, that what may happen that even though X is not empty, then this set will be empty. Because eventually you remove all the sources, and eventually what you remain is with a cycle. And then you have this empty set. You see, X, there is no vertex in X satisfying this condition. And now your task is to choose an element from the empty set. It's impossible. So at this point, an exception will be thrown. It's a kind of failure. But programming languages deal with the failures all the time. So instead of just stop, you throw exception, and you handle this exception, as they say. Okay. Now, in order to execute this program, we go to this class vertex, and we provide one field, an integer field called key, and a particular method which allows us to print keys. Okay, and this is a particular graph that we will be demoing this program at. So now we'll compile this program. So this a compiler that we wrote, I shouldn't say we, I'm the theorist of the group. Everybody works, and I pretend to know what they should do. And what it compiles to, C#, which is a new powerful language of Microsoft, and then uses standard C# compiler to compile to what it calls .NET runtime, a kind of virtual machine. Okay. Fortunately, the theorists didn't introduce any errors. Okay. So, I didn't show you... show you the main. So, I wrote this... I ran this program 30 times. Where is it? In order to demonstrate the non-determinism. Okay. This is try and catch. So, if the graph is cyclic, then an exception will be thrown, and here it will be handled. So the algorithm will stop and will write graph is cyclic. Okay, but our graph is not cyclic. So let me go back. So we ran it 30 times, and that's what we got. Now let's see whether it's correct. Here is the first number is 8, or first vertex is 8. Indeed, it's a source. Here is 7, it's also a source. Here is 5. Okay. 0, it's always at the end due to topology of this graph. So, you see how it works. Now, you may have an impression that it's such a simple algorithm, very easy to program. It is not true. So here is topological sorting in Modula 2, which is quite a good, powerful language, written by the great master, Niklaus Wirth. And it is not such a simple program. It's quite complicated. Okay. And it's an implementation. It's completely deterministic. So the graph is the vertices of the graph are given to you in certain order. And you use this original order. So let me move forward. So SML is wonderful language. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to work on it. But for people who are interested in programming languages, just have a look. And again, it was not me who is the program designer. So our chief ASML designer is Wolfram Schulte. Very talented fellow. Was my first hire from the University of Ulm in Germany. And if tomorrow I leave Microsoft, and Microsoft should be happy with having Wolfram there and a few other people that he and I already hired together. So ASML is more than just a programming or specification language. It's a toolkit, and I have only a couple of slides, and I will finish. So that's things what... How do you work with ASM models? So typically, imagine you caught a product group at the moment when the architect just finished his design. Okay. So you write a model in ASML, and what happens... You remember this V diagram? How it was? This way. So on the left there was requirement. And the right there was a model. So it's very important that your model is executable and not only declarative. Because if it's not executable, it's still very useful. Okay. So there are, say, language Z, one of the most known non-executable specification languages. So you have a text you can read, high-level text, you can comprehend, and it's useful. But if you have an executable model, then you can also play with it. You can experiment. Okay. And you can play scenarios, and you can validate in the engineering sense, not necessarily in mathematical sense. Sometimes in mathematical sense, but in the scale of Microsoft, we deal with large programs where mathematical verification is typically out of question. Not always, but typically. But engineeringly, you can validate, debug, and they're always surprised when you find bugs because people come who knew nothing about it, and now they found a bug in my product, which was supposed to be so right to begin with. Okay. And then this model will guide the implementation. So the implementation will be a refinement of that model. And then there are various, there is a problem of enforcing the model. I think, let me first say, what is a model? So there's a couple of misconceptions. So a model is an abstraction of a system. It's always an abstraction. What level of abstraction, it's up to you. You can model on a very low level. Typically, we model on a higher level. And certain things, certain problems are below our level. Say, buffer overruns, typically on the level that we don't see. But we can model on this lower level. And the model, at least in our case, since the model is executable, gives you a behavior specification. This is very important. So, for example, if you go to Windows, they have a zillion of drivers built in. Huge number of drivers. And do you know something? Maybe I say and give an example for at least for the mathematicians what a driver is. So, for example, I installed XP, and we had at home old scanning machine. So I called the company that produced the scanner, and they said, I have an XP, so I need a new driver for your scanner to work with XP. They said, no, we don't have such a driver. You have to buy a new scanner. Okay, I just tried anyway. It worked. So just by default, so a lot of drivers are built in. Now imagine you do such a driver. You are in a company that produces such a driver. What does the driver is supposed to do? Okay. And the documentation typically is such that the behavior is not described. Just in natural language, they give you an idea what do they want. Okay. Now this. There are many syntactic ways to hint what how it works. If you know, there are these so-called interfaces, and they have well-chosen names which suggest something, okay, but don't oblige you. Okay. Now, with a model like this, you describe exactly the desired behavior. Okay. So when your window goes blue, the chances are one of the drivers gave you trouble. And it's not because that they're bad people. They would love to do it right the right way. Okay. But they don't have the behavioral specification. So this is a really, really important thing. Now, what models are not? So one misconception is the model is a prototype. And it's not. Prototype is a kind of dirty implementation where a model is an abstraction which is supposed to guide any implementation. And in a sense, models are sort of high-level implementations, but it would be a little misleading to describe this way. It's better to think about as a high-level spec with implementation to be written later. And how do we enforce? So when you have a model, executable model, so imagine you have some kind of device which accepts commands. Say, you know, stop, open, run. Okay. So you can send a sequence of such commands to your model. Okay. Write them down. The sequence will be your test case or test suite. Write down also the results. You know, suppose you say, read. And it reads, say, character, and it shows you a character. Then you go to implementation, which may be not available to you, maybe in a different country. So you send them your test suite together with the results, and the test suite together with the result constitute an oracle, a test oracle. And then they write the same sequence, and they watch their results and compare with your results. So if the whole thing is deterministic, the result should match one-to-one. If there is slight non-determinism, then the result should match. But then there's a problem, especially as amount of non-determinism grows, there is a certain divergence, and eventually this thing becomes impractical. So we have a different tool, which works as follows. So think about some kind of a component. So the first component that we played with was a debugger, standard debugger of the Visual Studio. And we had a relatively high-level model for it. Now imagine somebody needs to use this debugger or that component as a client. He sent a signal, and then this is our tool. For a while, we called it a spy. It forks the signal to the model and to the implementation. Okay. Each of them does something to the signal, comes up with a certain result, and then you compare results. But now, this spy is clever. Suppose implementation said the result should be between 1 and 17. Now, here, as the model says, it should be between 1 and 17. If implementation says it's 25, okay, then spy says it's discrepancy, something is wrong, one of you guys is wrong. Okay, that's it. End of it. Now go and investigate. Now, if this guy says 7, that's fine. Then the spy goes back to the model and says, so far so good. And in fact, it's 7. Since the implementation is so much more powerful, it knows much more. But now this information is passed to the model. The model adjusts. And now they can proceed. So what you do, you have a kind of lockstep a computation or simulation. Okay. So in reality, it looks somewhat different. This is in principle. In reality, it looks differently. In reality, what happens, you have this code, implementation code, and woven into it is the code of the model. Okay. And one secret is, which I didn't know until I went to industry. Doesn't say much of academia in my department. I was on theoretical extreme. That for any product, the software companies have at least two sets of code. The code that they sell, and then what they call the debug version, which provides all kinds of things. The problem is that the code may not automatically have the necessary information. Certain variables which you want to know may be not present. And so, but this debug mode typically produces because they have to test. And so this debug mode gives you additional information about the state of the implementation. Okay. And so we just run this implementation and on a side also run the model. Okay. And if there is discrepancy, we stop. Okay. Things actually are more complicated because it's possible that immediately it's not clear that it's 7. The implementation doesn't tell you immediately what it is. You have to wait. And so the indeterminism will be resolved later. So in reality, it's really all undecidable. But it's not logic. You cannot just say it's undecidable and walk like a hero away. You have to work with it, whatever it is. And this is my last slide. The academics like to joke about theory and practice. Okay, here are two jokes. Here is one. What's the difference between theory and practice? Do you know this? In theory, there is none. That's the joke. Here is another one. A theoretician, a theorist speaks. It works in practice, but does it work in theory? Nevertheless, I believe that there is really nothing more practical than good theory. So one incredible example, probably maybe the best example that computer science has, is the parsing theory developed originally by Knuth, which enabled modern compilation theory. And we hope that in our small ways, we provide a little demonstration of this thesis. Thank you. Is there a question? Yes, please.
What's the largest specification in terms of lines of code that ASML has written?
The largest is probably not written by our group. There is a little company in Seattle which works with our group and writes specifications and does a little teaching for Microsoft. And so they wrote longer texts, longer programs. Twenty 20,000 lines of code. Typically, in our rough statistics, about the spec is about 10 times shorter than in the code. And I don't know what have you expected. So sometimes you could expect it to be much shorter. But certain things we cannot eliminate because if you come with, as I mentioned, with a standalone tool, it's of no use to anybody. So the huge portion of SML tool itself, huge. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The group wrote largest, and it's big, the tool itself is written in SML. And that is quite large. Okay. So most of people in my group have PhDs in compiler construction, so very sophisticated. And this is by far the largest. Unfortunately, I have no idea how many lines of code. But what I want to say that a code, a big part of a code often is, you know, how to deal with other components, how to deal with .NET runtime and so on, and that we have to preserve. So SML is many facet languages. It has this mathematical part, which I exhibited to you. Okay. But then it is essentially a superset of C#. And because we cannot afford, you know, marshal any data. It has to be a practical language. It compiles to .NET runtime. It's a member of .NET runtime, which is a very, very important thing. By the way, if somebody works in programming languages, now I think Microsoft is very, you may get a good funding. Microsoft is interested in having all the languages represented in this .NET runtime. Having it as a platform for various languages. So suppose you have some beautiful class written in Java, and Java is a member of this .NET runtime, so we can use it via this .NET runtime. We can just, if I can name an object of your class, I can use it, and the other way around. Okay, so this is part of, that's why our code cannot be too small. Also, another thing, to be fair, the code typically ignores things which are often heavy, like backward compatibility. So there are certain things we just ignore. Mm-hmm. More questions?
Yeah. I consider ASM as an approach to bridge the gap between requirements and the implementation of software. Compared to hardware design automation, would you think that a similar success would be possible for software as well? So if a significant part of this process is automated.
So let me repeat the question. So this abstract state machines, Hoover says, bridge between requirements and the code. And I certainly see this way too. And in hardware, there are such bridges. So SML itself was used, ASMs were used, and model checking was used. So there were quite important successes. Probably model checking was by far the most famous success in hardware applications. Now, software, so the question is, do we hope to achieve something similar in software? And this is a very, very tall order. Software is much, much more complicated, much more heterogeneous. It's not that hardware is simple. If you take an Intel chip or AMD chip, to be fair, it is terrifically complicated. Nevertheless, there is a lot of uniformity. So if you knew previous architectures, you probably will recognize this one. And that's mostly what they have, those chips. There are also embedded chips, but nevertheless, there's a lot of uniformity. Now, if you go from one software program to another, they're so different. And the levels of abstraction is so diverse. You know, the hardware aimed at the hardware at a certain particular level. And in software, you have, in the same program, you may address very numerous levels. So we're certainly not there yet. There are several groups in Microsoft Research that work with us. I guess one big success, there is a group that designs components. So if you know, there is so-called DCOM, that Microsoft COM is, what is this, component object model. And the people who designed that have a group, very influential group, and they had their own specification language, and they abandoned it completely and adapted ASML. And so we took on us the responsibility to support them. But in general, we are not there yet. I certainly believe that we'll build this bridge. So we certainly have little bridges over little streams of software. But, you know, to do something like a huge bridge like they do now in Scandinavia between Sweden and Denmark, you know, to bridge between the specification of Windows and the implementation of Windows, that will take a while. And the ambition is so huge, so some of my directors became a little impatient. You know, okay, you are here 5 years. Like, what was that for the bridges? Okay. But more by and large, they are patient. And I think we're going there. I'm afraid to overstate, to be overly optimistic, but personally I am optimistic. Otherwise, I wouldn't be there. Because if, you know, for proving theorems, academia is still the best place. Okay. Yes?
I have two questions. The first is, I guess some applications are more suitable to use this kind of circuitization and this kind of decomposition into tasks that you can basically model, right? And some are less. Like when you do distributed programming, if your task is queried sequential, doesn't matter how many processors you have, you are going to basically do a sequential interpretation of the operation you have. What I'm trying to say is, are there different classes of application that can be, you know, easily modeled with this kind of tools, and some that are not is usually, you know, easily modeled, or it's less applicable this kind of modeling for that?
Oh, let me repeat the question. So the question was, there are different applications. Some of them may lend themselves easier than others to such formal treatment. And the second part of the question was, are there different classes of, say, abstract state machines which are aimed for different kinds of applications? And the answer is certainly yes to both. You made one statement which I want to... It was not so obvious. Even if the system is distributed, even if the algorithm is sequential, we probably will model it as a distributed system because it pays in general to be faithful, because there is this important notion of scalability. You know, it's distributed. Today they do it sequentially anyway, but tomorrow they may take advantage of distributivity. And if your model doesn't reflect it, it will be thrown away. So we always aim to be very faithful. In fact, I often argue. Last week, I argued with some very clever fellow. He was a PhD student in Stanford when I first met him. He wrote some questions to me about decision problems, harking back to my logician's past. And now he is working at Microsoft in a distributed file system group. And he has an algorithm for file replication. Very clever, very clean algorithm. And he wanted us to actually verify it mathematically. And it's one example of a system which lends itself very easily to formal description because it's so clean. His name is, by the way, Nikolai Bjorner. if I'm already tell good things about him, can as well give his name. And last week, I argued with him that we should take into account that all these various computers, the file systems that should be replicated, are created at a certain point. The computers become alive, then can die, and maybe be regenerated, or maybe remain dead. And he said, it doesn't matter. Clearly, algorithm will work. And he is right. The algorithm will work. But I want this to be a lemma and not an axiom. And so, okay, he got my point very quickly. So other people sometimes don't. But I just want to say that this is not just a declaration. We truly try to be faithful, even if the customer doesn't see any point in it, because it is very important often. Okay, but otherwise, your declaration was completely correct. So there are some systems which lend themselves well. The systems that lends themselves worst to such treatment are those which were around for a long time. One example, a few years ago, I was going for sabbatical, and two of my options were to go to Paris or to go to AT&T. Paris looks much, much better, certainly better food. And but AT&T was attractive because maybe you can do something. You know, it's such an important company. Maybe not anymore, but it was 8 years ago. And one thing that turned me off was that the switch, the main switch, which a kind of centerpiece of their software, nobody knows how it works. They told me. So if you want to change one line, it will go through several committees, because these people understand this aspect of it, and these people understand that feature, and so on. And so they rely for this natural intelligence to somehow spot possible problems with what you're doing. Now, in this case, there is not much you can do with formal methods. You know, it's like natural language. It's such a huge complexity. Okay. That's why I think, by the way, that Sanskrit is an artificial language, because it's so clean. You know, they have all these rules with no exceptions. And yes, there are different classes of abstract state machines. So actually, we saw two of them. My first example was sequential ASMs. And since a particular class, and for sequential algorithms, by sequential algorithms I mean algorithms which work in sequential time and change the state only locally, just a little bit. Okay, but for this class there are the sequential abstract state machines. Then there are parallel, though not distributed, abstract state machines, and then there are distributed abstract state machines. Then there are also real time abstract state machines. So we do have those classes. Yes?
I just want to ask a question. Is there any relation between this ASM and unified modeling and language, UML? I know that UML is not executable. Can you, like, if you have this design using UML, these use cases and everything, can you model this by your ASM or implement the ASM?
Yeah, I understand. What's the connection between UML and ASML? Once I happened to be on a bus with a very famous person in computer engineering. I'm not sure he wants me to give his name. He wrote books, very popular in software engineering, beautiful books. And I didn't know much about UML. We just were returning from a lecture about UML. And I asked him, is this UML any good? And he said, this UML pushed the state of art 20 years back.